Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So while those two beautiful Pinots are warming up, which we're about to taste, I wanted to ask you about that bottling pain point, because I am so curious about it. So why is that the least favorite?
Well, I don't know who it is for him.
Or at least it could be.
When we get together with Bill, a lot of times at company lunches, Bill has a family tradition of before you start the meal, you talk about your thorn and your rose.
Yeah.
Huh.
And it could be in your day, your week, whatever. And so when we first all got together, it was during that retreat that we tasted the Gap's Crown Chardonnay from Gavin. They asked my rose and my thorn, and my thorn was bottling. Mm. And the reason for bottling is I still haven't learned to relax, because it is the last step. Mm-hmm. Before it literally leaves the nest.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do anything to it. I can't correct anything. If it's not done right, it can really affect the taste of that wine, short term, mid term, and long term. So for me, it's just, it's worse than harvest. I mean, I like harvest. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Harvest is great. Bottling is making sure that you're playing that chessboard at the highest level. And you've got to win the game. Losing isn't an option. And for me, still, it's if I didn't have to bottle, I would be fine with that. But I know that we have to bottle, so I'm good.
I think from a sort of the nuts and bolts of bottling, it's, you know, imagine you've got all these different vendors. So you've got glass companies you're working with. You've got labels. You've got capsules. You've got corks, and then you've got your wine that you're putting up to tank and you're getting ready for bottling. So it's all of these things that all have to go perfectly together at the last moment. And if any one of them is off, it could screw up the whole thing. So if your glass comes and maybe there's some manufacturing defects in it. Maybe you're finding air bubbles in it, or maybe the necks have what's called slug neck, where there's a little notch in it because the cooling process didn't happen perfectly at the manufacturer. So, and that can happen with capsules as well, where the color's wrong or scuffing.
It's smeared or,
corks, you know, or the coating on the corks isn't perfect, so they're not going in easily. So there's all these things that can go wrong, and you're trying to make sure they all go right, or at least as right as they can. Mm-hmm. And then you're getting that wine ready, and it's your last shot. And so for me, it's one of the most nerve-wracking, but it's also the flip side of that is you're sending your kid off to school, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're putting them in, you're just kind of like, this is what we've got.
It's rewarding at the end of the day, you know, whether the day went well or not, you make it through the day. Mm-hmm. You really do. And you help each other out. And we've had to do some, you know, where somebody stands there with towels and literally wipes off the top of every bottle because something was dripping. One of the filler spouts was dripping. And if you didn't wipe it off, it would drip on the white labels.
Wow. So, all the details again.
Yeah. And what you hope to get done in 4 days sometimes takes 5 days.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be in a hurry. You can't force bottling. Yeah.
So I was thinking, as you were saying, that when you literally just, there's nothing more to be done, that you have to let go. I remember a conversation with another rather highly regarded winemaker. I asked him a question when he's finished blending, and he said, when the bottling truck is in the driveway. It sounds like that might be the case here
it
as
is.
Well. So I want to take this to the blending mm-hmm. piece of it. So when did that perfect balance, that confluence that makes all the sense in the world occur? So does it is there still that infinite possibility, and you have to cut it off when you physically have to cut it off?
Yeah, I mean, we blend pretty early, so we'll, you know, we'll bring our wines up to tank and blend them in the January through March, you know, April of after, post-harvest.
Yeah.
So we just finished blending our 2018s okay. a couple weeks ago. So we do that blend early because we really want to see those wines age as one in barrel through its life. But there's always that last little tweak and tinker, and I would agree, there's... We taste it, you know, weeks before we go up to tank, before we're going to bottle. We taste it, you know, once it's up to tank, and then we taste it the day of. And if there's a last minute tweak that we need to do, then we've got to do it then, or forever hold your peace. You know, that's.
Do you get that sense that you've achieved that harmony? It's like, well, maybe, or do you feel very secure once you?
I'm never secure. I, you know, well, I mean, it is what it is. But
yeah. I think. Do you feel that secure? No, because the wine is alive. It's going to keep evolving. So you become more confident the longer you work with those blends or you work with those vineyards. Mm-hmm. So, like going into the bottling the 18s, I feel a lot more at ease. Mm-hmm. Knowing the direction the wines are going to go once they are bottled. You know, what's hard that Ryan didn't kind of expound on during our blending process, when we're teaching the younger winemakers, our enologist, our assistant winemaker, as we're putting those blends together, you know, sometimes their comments on the blend is, you know, it's really acidic, or it's, you know, too tannic. Mm-hmm. And Ryan said at one tasting that if it tastes really good now, that you're in trouble later on. Huh. So you've got to understand the ageability of those tannins. You've got to understand the ageability of that, how that acidity is going to affect the ageability. So we want it going back to barrel in February or March, little tannic, because we're actually going to throw even a little more tannin on it by the amount of oak, new oak we decide to use. So I think it's educating them through that process. And a lot of times Ryan and I really are on the same page, or we're picking, you know, if there's a trial, an acid trial we've done, and there's five or six, there's the control in five levels, we tend to be either on the exact same bottle or one way or another. And they're very, believe me, these are very tiny tweaks. But I've noticed that as you're training younger winemakers, that they tend to, they want the instant gratification. But that's also part of their generation. I think the millennial generation sees things like now. I'm not going to worry about it in 10 years because I don't own a Vinotech, and I'm not going to age my wine for 10 years. Like you said, it's going to be aged in the back of my trunk for 30 minutes till I get home, and then I'm popping the bottle.
Yeah.
And that's not our job as winemakers. We've got to be thinking, okay, when is the Adobe going to release these? Mm-hmm. When would we think we would want to drink these?
Yeah. You know?
And I tend to like a little age on my wines.
I think that's one of the hardest, or, you know, people say, what's the hardest part of winemaking? Or I feel like it's knowing where the wine should be at the various points in its life. You know, when you're doing a barrel sample versus, or even when you're tasting fruit, you're going out and you're tasting, trying to decide when to harvest. Once that fruit tastes, you know, at its perfect deliciousness, it's too late.
Wow.
So you've got to back, you know, everything has to be pulled backwards and saying, yes, we want it to be tannic or oaky or
acidic
at this
almost
at this
counterintuitive.
Point.
It is, yeah.
And the question is how much, you know, it could be tannic, or it could be really tannic, or it could be really, really tannic. And so where do you want it to end up, and where should it be at that time? And that just comes with experience, I think.
Yeah. That projection ability, when you can kind of see in your mind's eye where it's going and able to calculate correctly the parameters as to where you can catch it
right.
in that continue.
And you can't just look at numbers because the pH isn't going to tell you anything.
Yeah.
And neither is the. I mean, they'll give you a ballpark. Yeah. You know, if the alcohol's X, and you know, it may not calm down in 10 years.
Wow.
You know, and it may still be alcoholic.
And
I mean, I'm trying to think who. It might have been Louis Martini that said, if a wine is over-oaked now, it'll be over-oaked in 20 years. And I think that's correct to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
The perception of oak early on is very different than it is once it's aged. So that would be my argument mm-hmm. to that statement. Mm-hmm. But I do agree with him that if it's out of balance now, it's going to be out of balance later. You know.
So again, that sense
of... For my taste.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's also that sense of responsibility because you're letting it out in the world like you described.
Mm-hmm.
And you do want to produce something that has a stamina, should people choose to pursue it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. And, absolutely. And in the realm and the price point we're trying to hit, definitely. You want people to know that if they leave it in their cellar for 3, 4, 5, 7 years, it'll actually get better. We don't
think
it'll diminish.
And California, you know, has such relatively short history, you know, post-prohibition that people are aware of, that of course the old world can boast longevity because they have a track record. They have proof of concept in California. We're still, you know, validating it.
Right.
So I think it's an important work that you do that goes to proof of concept.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I cannot hold back anymore. I've got to try those Pinots. It's time for Pinots. So we're tasting the Price Family Estate first. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's 2017 as well. And what is the fruit source for that particular bottling?
So it's a blend of all of our estate fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got six estate vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
So the Durell Vineyard here in Sonoma, One Sky, which we talked about before, Gap's Crown.
Yep.
We've got two vineyards in Sebastopol, Russian River,
mm-hmm.
William James and Alana, and then Wallala Vineyard up in the far Sonoma coast. So what we do, this is a really fun wine for us as winemakers, because we get to blend together and sort of create a wine that we can envision in our minds rather than it being a vineyard designate. So most of our other wines are vineyard designate wines, which I think the goal with those is to showcase the site, let the site speak for itself. With this, we have a little bit more leeway where we get to, you know, take the components from each of those vineyards that we like and layer them in with other components from the other vineyards. So with this wine in particular, it's about 50% from the Wallala Vineyard.
Huh.
So we have a nice big, I mean, that's sort of our core to this wine. And then we get to layer in those various components. So, you know, we get the sort of aromatics from Wallala and some of the intensity. And we get some of the darker fruit from Durell and some of the cool blue fruit from Gap's Crown. So it's the wine that I always have the most fun putting together with Bob and the team, because we all get to just, we go through, we taste through, we create all those vineyard designates and then layer those into this and get to, you know, select barrels and showcase the fruit that, you know, Bill's got all these amazing vineyards, and this is our opportunity to showcase them as a cohesive unit. So
yeah, no, I mean, I'm a bit stunned again because just the sheer number of components you have to work with. I mean,
it's a lot of lots to kind of narrow down to.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, I mean, I wish I was a fly in the wall just to watch you go through this closet.
It takes a while to do, though. I mean, with, you know, we kind of start with the single vineyard wines because it's less complicated in that by sheer number of lots. So we can focus on Gap's Crown, we can focus on Durell. But then it's after you've done that is taking, saying, okay, how do we take proportional amounts of these single vineyard wines wines and then create what we think is the ultimate Sonoma Coast wine. Well, especially from very vastly different areas. I mean, just look at the yes. four soil types here.
Yes, no, this is absolutely fascinating. That wine has so much interest just for that reason alone, to have that many components included and to find a, you know, perfect combo, you know, as perfect as it gets, as mm-hmm. we decided. You know, you say it was fun. To me, it would be very, very intimidating to even attempt for like lay purposes to put it together, but what you achieved here is so interesting aromatically and palatally. It has this beautiful, very feminine fruit.
Mm-hmm. It does, especially the 17s.
Yeah, it's just so fragrant.
Much more feminine, and yeah, aromatic.
Kind yeah, of it's so beautiful, but it also has a lot of structure and texture and, you know, a lot of backbone to it.
I think what I find really interesting about it is it showcases this our 17 vintage as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's very appropriate for what we get out of 2017 as a whole, is sort of a little bit more feminine, a little bit more sort of fine tannins and elegance, I guess, rather than mm-hmm. sort of opulent fruit or anything that's sort of showy in your face.
No, it's definitely elegance and kind of intellectual qualities as well. So there's that hedonistic element because it is so beautiful aromatically and palatally and pleasing, but clearly something you can ponder for quite a while and have a long conversation about.
Yeah, and you know, from a winemaking standpoint, you know, we're talking about creating these vineyard designate wines first, but you know, when this wine comes into the winery, or when the fruit comes into the winery, we ferment these separately in small vats, and we use dairy, our own version of a dairy milk tank. so it's, if you take sort of a tall cylinder and you turn it on its side and cut it in half, that's what our tanks look like.
Oh, very cool.
And the reason we do that is you get a little bit more skin to juice ratio, where you have a much thinner cap because you've got a, you know, more of a surface area on the top there.
Think of a tank then cut in half. Mm-hmm. So you've got a long, skinny, tall tank instead of a tall, skinny tank.
That makes a lot of sense.
And so the cap, you know, is there's more skins in touch with juice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you don't have to be quite as aggressive with the punch downs or the pump overs.
Is this unique practice?
It is.
Yeah, so this was the original idea that came from you, or?
I had been experimenting. Well, I used a lot of the dairy vats over mm-hmm. at William Selyem and mm-hmm. saw what I liked about them. There were a lot of things I didn't like about them too. How you had to move the grapes out of the mm-hmm. out of the tank. How you had to clean the tank. So, I worked with a tank builder over about a 10-year period, and these were some of the first prototypes. Actually, we bought two for 3 sticks.
Very
and
cool.
Now we have about 6 or 7 of them, and I think we're buying
three more this year. So we, you know, it's basically you take that dairy milk tank and you put legs on it, and we're able to do things easier.
The bottom door where we can gently push the skins out. You're not kind of bucketing up and over.
It's amazing. They say devil's in the details, and that element alone. The contribution to the mm-hmm. final product. Again, how important is that?
Yeah. It's kind of fun to design some of your own equipment too. But
well, the best sellers are designed by winemakers, the best working sellers, right? Because you know what you look for.
You know what's going to work.
Yeah.
You know your pain points, you know what you wish you could do, and when you have those opportunities to do that. I mean, we were, to some extent, we were being able to start from scratch. We have, mm-hmm. you know, a number of really small 2.5-ton fermenters. These fermenters that we built were about 5, and that's about as big as we get. We don't get much bigger than that in terms of, so all of our lots are small, really small lot winemaking, and being able to, know, do exactly what we want with you know, being able to control temperature better,
sure.
being able to control how the cap thickness, it's fun to tinker with.
I bet. No,
and we have to be really cognizant of labor.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
Because it's getting more and more difficult to find skilled labor to come in.
Yeah, no, that's definitely
during
becoming an
harvest.
issue. Well, I hate to move on to yet another wine, but not really, because it smells so good. So this is a Russian River Valley.
Yeah, and actually most of our purchased fruit goes into this.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we use a little bit of fruit off of our Alana and William James, but we buy fruit from a couple of other growers in the Russian River Valley.
And Russian River always has such distinct, whether it's a blend or a single vineyard, it's just this plush and lush fruit. Can't hide in that, would you?
No.
I mean, it's
and
so
why
generous.
Would you want to?
Yeah.
You know, we sought out an older vineyard, well, older for us.
Yeah.
Planted in 1994, I think, by Warren Dutton, and it's a Pomard vineyard down by Iron Horse, so not too far off of Atascadero Creek. So it's a fairly cool area of Russian River. So it retains real good acidity, but it adds that real nice textural component that you don't get from some of the Dijon clones or, you know.
Wow, so that's what accounts for this very rich flavor and texture profile.
It is. It's, and it's very different from the
extremely
the
so. Yeah. But
and what's also interesting to me with these vineyard sites, so they're all in the Green Valley of Russian River. So it's the cool side of Russian River, which you still get those plush aspects of Russian River that are sort of typical to Russian River, but you also get a little bit more tension in the wines from those cooler sites and the clones that we're able to use.
A little more acidity.
Acidity and energy and that tension that you highlighted, definitely just such a different animal.
Yeah. And it's just different from, you know, say the Santa Rosa Plain or even up off of like Vine Hill Road or West Side Road or East Side Road, where, you know, the day temperature definitely gets probably gets warmer in Green Valley, but for not as long.
Okay.
So it cools down. The temperature warms up and cools down much quicker in Green Valley than you see like on West Side Road. So the temperature curve on West Side Road or East Side Road is much more gentle, and on Green Valley or even out west of Sebastopol, you know, it gets hot and then cools back down
really fast.
No, that's absolutely fascinating. And we were tasting five wines, of course, but I know that you make a lot more than that. It's a really extensive portfolio, including single vineyard wines that I'm sure are quite fascinating in their own right.
Yeah, this is our spring release. So with the spring release, we pretty much do our AVA blends. We do a couple of single vineyards off of it for that, but most of the single vineyards get released in the fall with our fall release. So we'll do a release in the spring and one in the fall, and generally the single vineyards come out with that because they have a little bit more time in barrel. They get a little bit more need a little bit more time to sit in bottle as well before we release them. So
well, that's also a bonus because that way you control a bit more before it flies the nest. And
even
if somebody were to get into it right away, at least, you know, you've secured success. I see a wine in the list that really intrigues me, the cuvée selection, Cuvée Eve Marie, which is an homage to Bill's wife, which sounds very, very special. And quite a few Chardonnay selections, which makes me very happy because I'm just falling in love over here. I've always loved your wines, but just the level of sophistication in, of course, both Pinots and Chardonnays, but Chardonnay in particular. Is very impressive, and I hope folks take note because you have created such a diverse portfolio, including the fun rosé that we tried, including the white blend. There's so much to experience. So I get to ask you a fun question now.
Okay. Fun question. I thought they were all pretty
good. I know.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Okay,
but like a little off subject, but not really. You obviously work a lot with Pinot and Chardonnays, and if you were to identify as a variety, if you were to be reincarnated in a variety, what would it be? I'm putting this guy on the spot, totally. He had no idea I was going to ask this.
Well, I don't. I think for me, and I hope this isn't too much of a cop-out, but I think probably some of the reasons I like Pinot Noir so much is because of its versatility. And I love that I can drink Pinot Noir with pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. There's so many versions of Pinot Noir. You can, you know, mm-hmm. you can have more sort of acidic versions. You can have more plush versions, and you get that in all cases. But I guess as a person, as a personality, I like to try a lot of things and do different unique things, and I like playing well with others. So yeah. I guess I would say Pinot Noir, and it's probably my favorite variety to drink as well. So
wow, well, thank you. That's I'm a Pinot nerd, so I, music to my ears. Anybody that wants to be Pinot Noir is good good with me. How about you, Bob?
You know, I could pick a white and a red. The red Pinot, but for a little different reasons, because I think Pinot is difficult. I think it can be obstinate. I think it can be extremely happy and pleasurable. But in the end is loved by all.
Aww.
So I think that I would want to come back as Pinot Noir. From, again, a winemaker's point of view, too, on a white Riesling, I'm fascinated with Riesling, and I have been most of my career. And I see Riesling as the Pinot Noir of whites. I think it shows its sense of place and its true personality more so than most white wine varieties I've worked with or had. And I like the diversity of style that you can make a Riesling. And so I think there's a lot of different layers to that grape, depending on where it's grown and how you want to make it. So
I can hear
if I had to come back as a white, I would come back as Riesling. Yeah,
I know a lot of sommeliers are very happy to hear that.
And yeah, they're about the only ones, though. I think they're the only ones that drink them and winemakers.
Yep.
You know, I know Arnie Lozen's done what he can to educate the world, literally, about Riesling, and I think I love that man on his mission, and I hope he turns everybody on to Riesling, and he doesn't even care if it's his Riesling, which is what I love about Ernie. He just wants you drinking Riesling and in the end drinking wine and enjoying life.
I think that's a great note to end on. And you guys have homework. You have to go after Three Sticks and investigate the portfolio again, anything from Pinot Blanc to really gorgeous Pinots and Chardonnays and so much to partake in. And secondly, is what Bob articulated so beautifully, please get out and drink some wine. Could be Riesling, could be anything, but participate. I thank you so much for spending time with me this afternoon. It's been so enjoyable to talk and taste.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, this was fun. I'm glad you could come and enjoy the adobe with us.
Exactly. Thank you.
And the sun finally came out.
I know.
So...
thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.